This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Pro-Russia separatists in several parts of Ukraine will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. British Prime Minister Liz Truss announcing yet another major military aid to Ukraine for next year. Also in the headlines, the UN chief warning of a looming winter of discontent in a world beset by multiple crises, from the Ukraine war to a warming climate. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafi. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with developments regarding Ukraine and Russia, pro-Russia separatists in several Ukrainian regions saying that they will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. The self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic passed a law earlier on Tuesday outlining details of the proposed vote. Russian media have cited sources saying that a vote is set to take place between September 23rd and 27th. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic also plans a vote on secession from Ukraine in the coming days. Authorities in the Russian-controlled southern Kherson region and southeastern Zaporizhia region also say that they will hold similar referendums not later than September the 27th. Moscow says it's up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia.
From the very beginning of the special military operation, and before that, we've been saying that the peoples of the prospective territories should decide their own fate. The whole current situation confirms that they want to be master of their own fate.
The coordinated moves have sparked Kiev's angry reaction, with the government pledging to, quote, eliminate Moscow's threat. The Ukrainian foreign minister says the proposed referendums will not change anything on the ground. In 2014, the Crimea Peninsula formally broke away from Ukraine and joined Russia, following a referendum. Now let's have an update regarding the fighting in Ukraine. Government forces there have advanced further into the east, reclaiming more areas from Russian troops. A video posted on social media shows Ukrainian soldiers walking on a road in Bilohorivka after regaining control of the area just west of the Russian-held city of Lysychansk. According to Ukrainian officials, the soldiers are now in full control of the area and preparing to retake the entire Luhansk province. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of northeastern Kharkiv province early this month. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have destroyed an armored vehicle repair plant in southern Ukraine. Now, the UK is doubling down on its support for Ukraine, with Prime Minister Liz Truss pledging to provide at least another $2.6 billion in military aid to Kiev next year. Truss also described Ukrainian forces' recent advances as inspirational. Truss, who is in New York for the UN General Assembly session, also pledged to rally support for Ukraine at the event. The UK is already the second largest military donor to Ukraine after the US. London has supplied Kiev with weapons including long-range rockets, anti-tank missiles, and air defense systems. Britain is also training Ukrainian military on the field. Robert Carter earlier told us that London's decision as regards the war in Ukraine would directly affect the lives of Britons.
Of course, I mean, that arguably is one of the main reasons why the West in general tends to be very interested in basically what's been described by others as a death economy. Keep war abroad going so that we can make a profit from that and keep our wealth in the Western world, at least the wealth within the establishment, going very strong. Of course, there are major arms firms which are going to benefit tremendously from ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We've seen Western arms manufacturers benefit greatly from a long and pointless, totally avoidable war in Yemen, for example. So, of course, there are going to be major benefactors from ongoing crisis in Ukraine. But the fact of the matter is that the ordinary British person is beginning to have direct consequences to their living standards as a result of this particular conflict. And that's why I think it is being looked at differently in comparison to, say, conflicts which Britain and America has supported for a long time in other parts of the world, like Africa and in the Middle East and so on.
Staying with the UK, the government is in trouble again over the ongoing cost of living crisis. A federation of trade unions launching legal action against the new law that allows the government to replace striking workers with other staff. Union umbrella group TUC, along with other unions, is set to challenge the government's decision to court. They argue that the right to strike is a fundamental British liberty. They say restricting the freedom to strike is a breach of international law. Workers across various sectors have gone on strike across Britain since summer as decades-high inflation erodes their earnings. The government of former Prime Minister Boris Johnson then amended the law to fill gaps caused by strikes. Then those elections are set to resume over the next couple of weeks, including railway workers over pay, job security, and working conditions. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has opened the 77th session of General Assembly in New York with a stark warning to international leaders that the world is grappling with multiple crises.
Excellencies, we need action across the board. Let's have no illusions. We are in rough seas. A winter of global discontent is on the horizon. A cost of living crisis is raging. Trust is crumbling. Inequalities are exploding. And our planet is burning. People are hurting, with the most vulnerable suffering the most.
Now, this is the first in-person gathering of world leaders at the 193-member General Assembly after 2 years of COVID restrictions. The UN chief stressed that cooperation and dialogues are the only path forward, adding that no power or group alone can call the shots. He said geopolitical divides have made the world unable to tackle major challenges threatening the future of humanity. Guterres also pointed out that the dire state of the planet lashing out at fossil fuel companies, the war in Ukraine, and mounting economic and environmental crisis are on top of the agenda during this year's UN General Assembly meeting. Okay, now let's go to the UN, and we have our own man, Ramin Mazahiri, is now in New York, close to the UN headquarters. Ramin, so just got on the way, UN General Assembly, the 77th one. And we had the opening speech. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the first time the UN has met in the last 3 years. Certainly, there has been plenty of turmoil in the world since then. There are a lot of world leaders who are not here, including U.S. President Joe Biden. Biden is getting some criticism for that he is missing a real opportunity for internationalism in order to worship at the feet of the former master of the United States, whom the United States had a revolution against. However, moving on. Today we had the start of the General Assembly with the Secretary General Guterres. He was mostly harping on about the climate crisis, but more than that, he was talking about how the entire world right now is having so many problems, and this is really what other people are going to focus on, namely Russia, food security, inflation. And this is something that Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi mentioned yesterday, that really all of these problems, they are caused by unilateralism. And we are here at the UN, which is the essence of the absolute contrary of the idea of unilateralism, which is internationalism, multilateralism, mutually beneficial cooperation. However, many countries here, they really believe that the United Nations is something that is dominated by Western powers. And many of the Western powers and the Western journalists, they will hopefully learn by the end of this week when it comes to topics like Russia, where here at the UN, the overwhelming majority of countries voted not to condemn Russia for their war with Ukraine that has been going on since 2014. That vote, hopefully many journalists here will remember. Only the English-speaking countries and Europe voted to condemn Russia. However, during this week, it's certainly expected that all of the Western leaders will use their speeches as a chance to really bash Russia and really condemn them, even though it is their unilateral rejection of the Minsk Accords that and something that has been in place, as a process that has been placed since 2014 that has led to the very, very tragic results today in Ukraine. Tomorrow, Iranian President Raisi will speak. Thursday, he will have a press conference, and he's going to have bilateral meetings all this week. He has rejected meeting with U.S. President Biden.
Okay, that's right. You know, list of problems are there, but the thing is that they should join hands to see if this is going to happen. Thank you for that, Ryan Mazahir. Keep an eye on what's happening there. We'll come back to you at a later time. Ryan Mazahir, a correspondent at United Nations headquarters in New York. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is in New York City to attend the 77th U.N. General Assembly Summit. Now, the significance of the trip is not just about Iran's presence at the U.N., but rather Iran addressing the world from a position of strength. Now, perhaps at no other time in history has the West appeared to be in a weaker position compared to Iran that has placed diplomacy at the heart of its foreign policy.
When it comes to Iran and the U.N. General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen. I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ebrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ebrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example, he kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions, showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time.
Okay, let's move on. Russia has urged Armenia and Azerbaijan to resolve their territorial disputes via negotiations, and that's while fighting flaring up again between the two southern Caucasian neighbors.
I emphasize that we are seriously concerned about any conflict situations between states that are close to us. We call on everyone to show restraint, to observe the ceasefire strictly, and to firmly follow the trilateral statements by the leaders of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
The Russian president made a comment in a televised speech. The fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces first erupted last week. The two former Soviet republics have reported more than 200 fatalities. The two neighbors are bitter rivals. They have been clashing over ethnical and territorial issues since the late 1980s. Last week, a ceasefire put a temporary stop to the bloodshed. The latest clashes are the deadliest since the 2020 war that was ended with a Russia-brokered truce. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has lashed out at the U.S. and the Saud-led coalition over their meddling in his country's internal affairs. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that interference has reached an extent where Washington and Riyadh decide the formation of governments and the selection of ministers in areas held by former government loyalists. It says even a council management is selected by the Americans and Saudis. Al-Houthi noted that actions of the U.S. ambassador to Yemen is a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He said that the U.S. has been pursuing the goal of partitioning Yemen. Those comments were made in an event commemorating the 8th anniversary of the ouster of Saudi-backed former president Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. Ethiopia's flashpoint northern Tigray region is heading for yet another conflict. A local paramilitary group accuses neighboring Eritrea of launching a full-scale offensive in border areas. A spokesman for the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, says that Ethiopian government troops have also joined the offensive. Neither Eritrean nor Ethiopian government officials have responded to the allegations. Tigray plunged into bloodshed 2 years ago after the federal government launched a war on forces loyal to TPLF. Addis Ababa then imposed a blockade on the region after rebels refused to pull out of the areas that they'd captured in Afar and Amhara regions. Months of fighting left hundreds of people dead and tens of thousands more displaced. A ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital city to honor journalists who lost their lives during the years-long war in the Arab country. Muhammad Ali has a report from Damascus.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism. Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the innate of seeking justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having the innate of seeking justice, or fitrah of seeking justice. We see that it is inside the mankind that mankind is striving for the justice, and it wants justice, it seeks justice. And wherever we see oppression, wherever we see a sin, wherever we see someone is taking the rights of others away, we start speaking out, we start shouting out, and we start to protest against such actions. And this protest, this feeling that we have, which we feel bad about the things, and through this feeling we judge people, this judgment is all based on our innate, because whoever does not observe justice, we don't like that person. We straightforward say or have a feeling in ourselves that this person is not right because he's taking over the rights of the others. He is oppressing others. We have many examples. For example, there were protests around the world when we had the incident of George Floyd, when the Yemeni children are bombarded by the Saudi Arabia, the people are shouting out, they're protesting. The things that are happening in Palestine, we can see that there are many things, many other examples which we see in our society or locally. We can see many examples around us, and we feel bad about this. Why do we feel bad? It's because it's in our inside, it's in our innate, that is telling us that this is not justice, it is oppression, it is injustice. And therefore, we feel bad or we protest against such actions. And this is what we say, that the innate is seeking justice. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of innate seeking justice. And we said that it's in our innate, it's in our fitrat, it's in our nature that we seek justice. And therefore, we see that from the signs of the intellectual or intellect is that al-amalu bi-sunnati al-adl. It is said that we need to observe the justice, we need to practice justice. And therefore, we see that Allah Tabatabai, even when he talks about the justice to be the part of innate, he discusses that, he says that the justice is equal to goodness. And the justice must have goodness in it. And if it is not having a goodness in it, then obviously this is not a justice, it is something else. And we know that the goodness itself is something which ourselves like it. We like to be good, we like goodness, we like to be dealt good by the people. And because we like all these things, this goodness, therefore we are inclined towards the goodness, and we are being, we can say, attracted towards the goodness. And whenever we are attracted towards the goodness, it means that there is something good in it. And the justice itself is something that whenever somebody observes the justice, the people, they like it. They praise the person. And even if it is against some people, but because he dealt with them with the justice, they even admire it. So therefore, this goodness, because it is being observed by the people, people like it, and people want the goodness, and we know that the goodness is part of justice. Therefore, justice is also something which is inside us, and we are inclined towards this justice and towards the goodness, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The last Israeli regime brutal assault on the Gaza Strip exposed once more the hypocritical and immoral response of the West to the ongoing genocidal policies of the Zionist regime in the occupied territories. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ilan Papp, author. This article is published under the heading, "When will the West publicly endorse the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves?" Stay tuned for more. The last Israeli regime brutal assault on the Gaza Strip exposed once more the hypocritical and immoral response of the West to the ongoing genocidal policies of the Zionist regime in the occupied territories. The continuation of the callous policies and the Western government's responses, in particular the American and British ones, can naturally lead to desperation and paralysis, However, despair and inaction are a luxury Palestinians under apartheid, siege and occupation cannot afford. Therefore, the solidarity movement as well should do its best not to give in to a sense of helplessness, of hopelessness. It is important to record the continued insecurity of the West as it transpired once more this time, condemn this duplicity and counter it by exposing the fabrications and distortions on which it is based. The American president, the State Department, and the American envoy to the United Nations supported the Zionist regime's rights as they claim to defend itself in reaction to the Zionist regime's assault, as did the British Foreign Secretary, who will probably be the next prime minister in September. It is quite incredible to hear these statements at a time when every major human and civil rights organization on the globe defined the fake regime of Israel as an apartheid regime. The Western political elites chose to hail its right to self-defense. We should not tire and remind the world that the people who have the right to defend themselves are the Palestinians, and that they possess very limited means to do so, whether by armed struggle or by appealing to international law and institutions. In many cases, they were unable to defend themselves, neither in Gaza this month nor anywhere else in historical Palestine since 1948. When they do succeed in doing so, they are accused of being terrorists. The Western regime seemed to care very little for the Palestinian right to life, dignity, and property. The UN committed to doing so in Resolution 181 of November 29, 1947, and stood by when all these rights were violated during the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Since then, and in particular since 1967, none of the Western regimes ever attempt to protect the Palestinians when the Zionist regime army shot, killed, or wounded them with weapons supplied by the West or developed by its help. It also did nothing when their houses were demolished, their livelihood destroyed, or when they were ethnically cleansed. We can look at July 2022 alone and record some of the Palestinian victims whose rights to self-defense has not been recognized by the President of the USA or the Foreign Minister of Britain. These politicians were silent when during this month Saadia Farangla Matar, a 64-year-old mother of 8 and a grandmother of 28, died in the Damon jail, where she had already spent 6 months detained without trial. No one defended or acknowledged the right of life. In this very same month of Amjad Abu Aliya, a 16-year-old boy who was shot by Israeli regime troops, the list of those murdered just this month is long. It includes Nabil Ghanem, 53 years old, who tried to return home safely from working in the occupied territories and was shot dead by Israeli regime troops last July, and Taher Khalil Muhammad Maslat, a 16-year-old boy, shot on his way to school by Israeli regime snipers who aimed at him from a distance of 100 meters and killed him. Ohed Mohammed Odeh was shot dead in July in Almida, a village near Ramallah, a week that also saw the killing of Ayman Mahmoud Mohsen, aged 29, a father of three and a political prisoner for 3 years, who was killed in the Shia camp near Beitla, and Bilal Awad Khapa, aged 24, killed in Yabad. As the month just started, Muhammad Abdullah Saleh Suleiman, a boy from Silvan, was shot on Route 60, a settler apartheid road, by Israeli regime troops sitting on a watchtower. He was left to bleed for about 2 hours with Israeli regime troops preventing a Palestinian ambulance to reach him by firing on anyone approaching him. Muhammad died later from his wounds. The Zionist regime watchtowers are also spread near the Gaza Strip fence, but they are not manned. They are loaded with machine guns operated from the distance by young Israeli women troops, who were hailed by Israeli regime radio as heroines defending their homeland when they explained how they use a joystick on their computer to kill anyone approaching the fence. Since January 1, 2022, and until the Israeli regime assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh, the Zionist regime forces killed 61 Palestinians. These killings were part of what local and international human rights organizations described as a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians, prodded by Israeli regime Prime Minister at the time, Naftali Bennett, to use lethal force at Palestinians who did not pose an imminent threat. Hundreds were wounded during Ramadan this year, in particular at Haram al-Sharif. As the death toll grew in this last attack, children such as Mumin Salem, aged 5, and Ahmad al-Nayrab, aged 11, in Jabalia were killed together with another 14 children between the ages of 4 to 16. Palestinian children also died because of the Zionist regime policy of denying medical permits to Gaza's children. Around 840 children have died while awaiting permits between 2008 and 2021. Nobody in the Western media or mainstream politics talked about the rights of the Palestinians who were maimed by Israeli regime shots this month to defend themselves. Nassim Shoman, a student walking on a side road near Ramallah, lost a leg, and his friend Osayed Hamayel was left paralyzed in a wheelchair after they were shot by Israeli regime troops. A similar fate this month awaited Harun Abu Aram from Yatta, who remained paralyzed from head to toes after he tried to prevent the troops of the Israeli regime from stealing his neighbor's generator. Similar silence was heard loud and clear from Western media when the Palestinian community of Ras Altin, 18 families were expelled from their homes last July, and when families in Masafer Yatta became targets for the Israeli regime military training. Nobody in London or Washington last July talked about the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves in the wake of Israeli regime Supreme Court's decision to approve the army's plan to expel about 1,000 Palestinians from the Masafer Yatta region, and nobody in the official West talked about the right of those Palestinians who are tortured by the fake regime of Israel to defend themselves. Last July, we learned from the Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Territories that the situation has become so bad that it decided to refer the Israeli regime to International Criminal Court. PCATI concluded that the Israeli regime is not interested and unable to stop the use of torture against Palestinians, a policy that constituted a war crime. It said that after 30 years of fighting torture, it had reached the unfortunate conclusion that the Zionist regime has no wish to end torture. Honestly, investigate victims' complaints and prosecute those responsible. Who will defend the Palestinians from the need to choose between two callous options in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? No one offers a third option. When will the leaders of the West publicly endorse the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves, as they do, for instance, in Ukraine?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The ocean of dua.
Al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam ziyaratan minni wa niyabatan an walidai.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyarat Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyarat al-Ashura. So stay with us. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this part of Ziyaratul Ashura. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ بْنَ مَرْجَانَ. May Allah distance from His mercy the product and the son of Marjana. Up to now, we have said that Ibn Marjana literally means the son of Marjana, and he was not the son of Ziyad, but Ziyad called this Ibn Marjana and his brother to himself, and he kept them as his own sons. And Ubaidullah, later known as Ibn Ziyad, was made the governor of Basra. In the previous episode, we said that one of the most fundamental atrocities Ibn Marjana committed was the merciless execution of Muslim Ibn Aqil, exactly the time when he was the governor of Kufa. To talk about the other atrocities he committed, we can mention the instigation of Umar ibn Sa'd to lead an army to Karbala and carry out the horrendous massacre of Ashura. The point is that he heard that Umar ibn Sa'd is somehow indecisive. He's not determined to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So he sent Shimr with an army to ensure that his orders were carried out, and they were both listening to him completely. He could not tolerate any kind of insubordination regarding the massacre of Ashura. Also, history tells us, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam's blessed head was brought before him in his court in Kufa, he began mocking at it, and he tapped Imam Hussein alayhi salam's lips with his cane. Sheikh Mufid, in his book Kitab al-Irshad, says he ordered that the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam be brought, and it was placed before him. وَأَمَرَ بِإِحْذَارِ الرَّأْسِ فَوَضَعَ بَيْنَ يَدَيْهِ. Then he began looking at it, smiling, and in his hand was a cane with which he struck the middle teeth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And beside him was Zayd ibn Arqam, the companion of the Apostle of Allah, who was very old. When he saw Ibn Ziyad hitting Imam's lips with that cane, he said to him, "Remove your cane from these two lips. For surely by Allah, besides whom there is no God, indeed I saw the two lips of the Apostle of Allah kissing them so many times that I cannot count. فَوَاللَّهِ الَّذِي لَا إِلَٰهَ غَيْرَهُ لَقَدْ رَأَيْتُ شَفَتَيْ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ عَلَيْهِمَا مَا لَا أُحْسِيهِ كَثْرَةَ تَقَبُّلِهِمَا. And then he started weeping. Ibn Ziyad said to him, "May Allah make your eyes weep. Do you weep upon the victory of Allah?" Ibn Ziyad told him, أَبْكَى اللَّهُ عَيْنَيْكَ أَتَبْكَى لِفَتْحِ اللَّهِ. And he continued, "I swear by Allah, if you were not an old man who was out of his senses, I would have beheaded you." This is only one aspect of the monstrous atrocity this Ibn Ziyad had.
When people ask, "I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right," go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, "I'm confused," say, "Please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion." You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is: do not allow tyranny. Do not allow evil doing. Do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah. He appreciates Him. He understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So these are only parts of what he did during his life, this Ibn Marjana. And as history tells us, Ibn Marjana did not live long after the massacre of Karbala, because Mukhtar Thaqafi ensured that he defeated and beheaded him because of what he had done against the grandson of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Our discussion about who Ibn Marjana is cannot be completed except by reminding you of this important point. The principle, as we said, is a very straightforward one. If someone understands, adheres to truth, and loves the epitomes of Islam, and even if such a person were to be the descendant of the likes of Marwan ibn Hakam, or Yazid, or Ibn Ziyad, he would be reckoned from among the people of the truth. But this la'n we are saying in this part, may Allah distance from His mercy the product of Marjana, we invoke the curses of Allah, not just on such exact person, the product of Marjana, there was only one, and we did not have any kind of Ibn Marjana afterwards throughout the history, but we are asking the Almighty Allah to distance from his mercy all those who have adopted the spirit of such a person. Those who, if they were given the chance in the history and in that time in the plains of Karbala, they were ready to do such atrocity. This is the secret of asking the Almighty Allah to distance from his mercy the product of Marjana. Thank you for staying with us, brothers and sisters. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.